This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is in Cuba today, meeting and talking with Cuban officials. She's part of the congressional delegation visiting the island after President Obama's decision last month to overhaul our Cuban policy. Reestablishing diplomatic ties that were cut with the 1962 embargo has a lot of people talking about visiting Cuba. But what would we find? Is Cuba indeed a country frozen in time, as many Americans believe? Here to talk about this is Ruth Behar. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, and she's the daughter of Cuban exiles. She was born in Cuba, and her family left in the 1960s. Ruth Behar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You had a piece that was published recently in the Washington Post and many other papers about what President Obama's decision meant to you and your parents. And you also have just got a piece out in the Huffington Post about what visitors to Cuba might and might not find. I want to start with those emotions that you felt when you got word of these changing American views and policies towards your homeland.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, well, it was intense. My heart was definitely going a mile a minute. I was so excited after such a long freeze to see the possibility of an opening of relations, which seemed like it would never happen. It really seemed like an eternal situation that we would just be going on with forever and ever, this kind of strange, you know, lack of relation between the U.S. and Cuba. But on the other hand, lots of grassroots relationships with Cuba, lots of people like me traveling to Cuba and making our own contacts with Cubans and with Cuban culture and Cuban memory. But then officially this sense of this freeze between the two governments. And it had a lot to do with pride on both sides. The American government didn't want to bow down to a small Caribbean nation that had dared to go communist 90 miles away from our borders. And then on the other hand, Cuba, with its own pride of national sovereignty, didn't want to have to bow to the U.S. either. So how was this conflict ever going to be resolved? I think it had a lot to do with actually male pride. And when suddenly there was this possibility of an opening and President Obama speaking to the Cubans directly in his speech, you know, and saying, no es fácil, it's not easy, but it was just so exciting. So I was thrilled. And at the same time, since all Cuban Americans are like this, we also carry our community, you know, on our backs. And I carry my parents' stories and that whole inheritance of knowing that my parents fled in the 60s, that they left Cuba at a very, very difficult time when you could be harassed and mistreated and persecuted for wanting to leave the country. It was a highly politicized time. You could call it a sort of political fundamentalism took root in Cuba, and you were either for the revolution or against it. There was no middle place that you could occupy. And if you chose to leave, you were a worm of the revolution.
And that's what you and your family were branded as.
And that's what we were branded. We were branded worms. So knowing what my parents went through, I was a child, I was only 4 and a half, and knowing what they went through and then seeing my father work 3 jobs when we got to New York, which is where I grew up, it was so painful. So immediately I was thrilled, but that happiness was muted by knowing that my parents had suffered, and was their grief being taken into account in this sudden opening and excitement? What about the grief of people like my parents, this older generation, many of whom have never been back, who've had this position of we're not going back until the political system changes? And I think it's a position of great integrity, and I respect it. So these are people that would love to go back. They have a lot of nostalgia for Cuba, but they made a vow to themselves not to go back until that regime changes, until the Castros are out of power. And that's the position that my father in particular holds on to. My mother is much more sentimental, and she cried when she read my piece in the Washington Post. She called to tell me she was weeping as she read it. She said, I really, really want to go back. I want to see Cuba again. I'm afraid, you know, that it won't be the Cuba I remember, but I still want to go. But she's so respectful of my father's position that she won't go unless he goes.
And right now he's still taking the hard line, isn't
he? He's still taking the hard line and saying, you know, this is not a good idea because it means that the U.S. is supporting a tyrannical government, a government that doesn't respect free speech. And so, like many in that line of thought, he just doesn't really think this is a good move. He thinks that the U.S. should have waited a little longer and just seen if the Castro government, you know, just eventually left power somehow. I think others of us felt that, you know, it's been a long time. It's been 50 plus years. And these are the people in government. These are the people that we need to negotiate with. And that we always need to think that ultimately what we want is the best for the Cuban people. So if this is going to be the best for the Cuban people, then it's the thing to do.
And you felt compelled to write for the Huffington Post about something that a lot of people have been saying ever since the president's announcement. Basically goes like this: I need to get to Cuba before it gets Americanized and too modernized and loses what makes it special. So as someone who was born there and someone who's traveled there a lot, what's your reaction to that?
There are lots of stereotypes about Cuba. It's to be expected. It's been the forbidden place, you know, for over 50 years. So lots of stereotypes and fantasies have been created about Cuba. And we have all the fantasies from before the revolution as well. So we have basically two sets of fantasies. We have the fantasies from the 50s. And so Cuba as this place of music and gambling and prostitution and the high life and all of that, right? And, you know, this incredible beach resort and all of that.
I've so heard people fondly remembering wild times in the 50s.
Wild times in the 50s. Yes. So we've got that whole image of Cuba. It was the place where you could go and let go, you know, and it was also the place where people went to drink, you know, during Prohibition. So there's all of this sort of Cuba as that place of letting go, you know. So there's all of those images, fantasies, stereotypes, desires placed upon Cuba that have to do with what Cuba was like before the revolution. But then there are all the fantasies that have been created since the revolution. It's like, oh, these are like the revolutionaries. They're the most different people and place from the United States that you can possibly imagine. No McDonald's there, you know, no Taco Bell, you know,
mega resorts.
Right, no mega resorts. So this is kind of like the other to American capitalism. So you have these two sets of fantasies coming together in how Cuba is perceived. And all of that has to do with, I think, with an image of Cuba as a place preserved in amber, as a place frozen in time, as a place that hasn't changed. And so we have to get there now before it changes. That's what I hear. I hear it all the time from very intelligent people. I need to get there before it changes. And
your reaction is, well, wait a minute, folks, it hasn't been frozen in amber.
It hasn't been frozen in amber. It has been changing like any society and culture. It's always evolving and changing. The Cuba of the 60s when the revolution began is not the Cuba that we're seeing now with Raul Castro in power, with the pragmatist brother in power. It's not the Cuba of Fidel Castro, but it's not the Cuba of the heyday of the revolution of the 60s when they thought we're going to change the world, you know, and what they did is they brought the world to them, but they didn't change the world exactly in the way that they wanted, you know. So the Cuba of the 60s is not the Cuba of the 21st century. These are different Cubas. Cuba has been evolving, and so Cuba has been changing, and people want to go to Cuba, especially very well-meaning Americans want to go to Cuba and find this place that's not capitalist, this place that's somehow authentic and primitive and real, where people live from dreams, you know, basically. And it's just not that way. Cuba is this very complex, very contradictory place. There still is a communist system in place, but on the other hand, people are finding various ways to be capitalist entrepreneurs. So it's this place really of complex contradiction. And that's what I'm really seeing in Cuba. So you're not going to go and find this place where everybody is either kind of a 50s cha-cha-cha dancer.
Like Desi Arnaz,
you know, who I loved.
Yes.
Or, you know, or everybody's wearing a Che t-shirt and going, yay, I'm a revolutionary. Let's keep making revolution. It's not one or the other. It's actually very, very complex, where those ideas crisscross, where you have many generational differences as well, where you have people from the older generation who actually remember pre-59 Cuba, and kind of their sense of what's going on is very different from somebody born in the 90s, when Cuba already was changing and opening up to capitalism after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so kids who grew up after the 90s or in this century don't remember all of that revolutionary stuff. You know, it's nostalgia
just
for
life.
Them too. It's just life, you know, and they want an iPhone. I mean, they, you know, they want to live in the 21st century like every other young person, you know? And the other thing that's happened that I think is very curious and interesting is I think politics was really so pushed onto people that now there's been a kind of response to it where people are very apolitical in Cuba, or they've moved into things like religion, because religion was suppressed throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s. And in the 90s, it became possible to actually have a religious faith and be a member of the Communist Party. And Cubans have really a strong sense of faith, particularly in the Afro-Cuban religions. And all of that had to go underground. And in the 90s, it kind of came back up into the fore. And so you see lots of people all over Cuba dressed completely in white from head to toe. And it's because they've been initiated into Santeria. And so you see that they have to wear white for a year. And that wasn't possible during the heyday of the revolution because they wanted people to stop believing in religion and to believe in the possibility of humans making change. It was that whole sort of communist perspective, atheist perspective. And they enforced that on people. And people kind of tried their best to live that way, but it didn't fit with the Cuban character where there's such a sense of faith and belief in spirituality. And so that's all kind of come back into the mix. And so you have just so many things mixed together, a fusion of so many different ways of thinking and of acting in the world. And that's what I think makes Cuba super exciting.
And Americans need to adjust their thoughts and give up the fantasy and be prepared to embrace the reality of what Cuba's like in 2015. I'm wondering, what are your hopes and fears for Cuba with this change in policy?
Well, my hopes, of course, are that, you know, the lives of everyday Cubans will improve greatly, that they'll have access to more things that they don't have easy access to now. You know, people are aware that internet is something that Cubans don't have easy access to. It doesn't mean they don't have access to it at all. They do. They find ways around the system. I have this acquaintance who gets, you know, time on the internet through a friend of a friend who's married to a Spaniard who has full access. And so she buys time from this person. And, you know, and she can get on and see what's for sale at Target, you know, and I think that's amazing. And to me, that shows that Cubans are not primitive others, as they're sometimes, you know, thought to be by Americans who haven't been there. But in fact, they're super savvy, postmodern people. They've kind of figured out the capitalist system. They've figured out the system that tries to suppress them in Cuba. And they've figured out all these ways around these systems that seek to block them, because there's this, kind of this internal blockade as well, as opposed to the external blockade imposed by the U.S. There's this internal blockade denying them access to certain things, whether it's the internet, whether it's certain consumer goods. But they find a way around all this. And to me, that makes them the super savviest people. And I think that's something that Americans really need to think about. They're not just going to, you know, connect with these primitives that are out in a jungle, you know, and they're barefoot, and, you know, and they don't know about modern life. They actually are, they're way beyond, because they really have figured out all these ways around, you know, a system that would seek to suppress them. They have really figured out a way to be free. And I think that's what makes Cubans such an amazing people.
Ruth's piece in the Huffington Post is entitled The Fantasy of Cuba, Where Time Stood Still. Ruth is a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. Born in Cuba, her family fled that country in the 1960s. Ruth Behar, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.